Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Thousands of people are pouring into Croatia, turning that nation into the latest hotspot in the 1,000-mile-plus exodus toward Western Europe after Hungary used tear gas, batons, and water cannons to keep migrants out of its territory. By Thursday morning, Croatian police said 6,200 people had entered the country since the first groups started arriving early Wednesday. Germany's vice chancellor is making a new appeal to other European countries to help shoulder the burden of the influx of migrants. Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel said in a video message Thursday that Europe needs to move, saying Germany is helping. The question is, who is helping Germany? VOA's Luis Ramirez is in Munich.
There is certainly frustration because Germany wants the nations of Europe to accept quotas, to each commit to taking 160,000 refugees in each year. That proposal has been met with huge resistance, particularly in Eastern Europe, and Hungary is one of the countries that says it does not want to accept those that number of refugees.
That is VOA's Luis Ramirez reporting from Munich, Germany. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet says she will travel to the coastal area hit hardest by a powerful 8.3 magnitude earthquake late Wednesday that killed five people and triggered a widespread tsunami warning. Wednesday's quake was centered about 500 kilometers north of the capital, Santiago, and was felt as far away as Buenos Aires on the opposite side of the continent. The earthquake was followed by a number of strong aftershocks, and many people spent the night outside as a precaution. Tsunami warnings remained in place for hours along Chile's coastline. This is VOA News. The head of Burkina Faso's new ruling council says the president and prime minister are safe in military custody and will soon be released. Brigadier General Gilbert Diender spoke to VOA's French to Africa service Thursday, one day after soldiers overthrew the West African country's transitional government. General said the military staged the coup because the country's political process was biased. He said he will start a political dialogue that includes all parties and will lead to elections at a date still to be determined. Officials in South Sudan say at least 60 people were killed when an overturned oil tanker exploded, incinerating those who were trying to siphon out the fuel. Mariam Tito, chief of the Mambe Mayan district, told VOA South Sudan in Focus program that the death toll is likely to rise due to the severity of many victims' burns. She said more than 100 others were injured in Wednesday's incident. Foreign affairs were a central focus at Wednesday's debate between Republican presidential contenders, each of whom argued they offer the strongest alternative to what they see as the weak policies of President Barack Obama. The 11 leading candidates who gathered at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California sparred over issues including how to deal with the Iran nuclear deal, a rising China and assertive Russia, and the Islamic State group. The Iran nuclear agreement, which has provoked widespread outrage in the Republican Party and is currently being reviewed by Congress, dominated much of the conversation. Top officials of the U.S. Central Bank are deciding whether or not to raise interest rates today in Washington. An increase would be the first rate hike in nearly a decade, though many experts expect the Federal Reserve will put off the hike until later this year. A higher interest rate would bring higher borrowing costs, which would tend to slow economic activity. It could also fend off inflation, but may hurt stock market values. The increase, however, would also be a vote of confidence by the Fed in the strength of the U.S. economy, which might bolster stock prices. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a series of suicide bombings in the Iraqi capital that killed at least 21 people and wounded more than 50 others. The attacks on Thursday struck two predominantly Shiite neighborhoods in central Baghdad. They resembled the frequent bombings there by Sunni militants during the past decade. Civilians and police were among the victims of the blast. The Islamic State claimed responsibility in an online statement. That's the Islamic State group claiming responsibility for a series of suicide bombings. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, I'm Yehi Swohib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A coup is shaking the West African nation of Burkina Faso. The Presidential Guard announced early Thursday that it had seized power, dissolving the transitional government just 3 weeks ahead of elections.
That's Emily Ayoub reporting from Abidjan. Details next. Also in the news, the European Parliament has backed a plan to distribute some 120,000 migrants and refugees among European Union member countries. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burkina Faso's military says it has seized power in the West African country and named a general to lead a new ruling authority. All borders and airports have been closed and nighttime curfew has been imposed. Brigadier General Gerbert Diendéré will lead what the military is calling the National Council for Democracy. Diendéré is a longtime ally of former President Blaise Compaoré, who was ousted in a popular uprising last year. Diendéré told the AP today he thinks national elections, scheduled for October 11, to replace the now deposed interim government, may have to be delayed. A soldier appearing on state television today announced the government had been dissolved and said interim president Michel Kafando has been stripped of his powers. Soldiers are still holding Kafando and the interim prime minister, who they arrested during a cabinet meeting yesterday in the capital, Ouagadougou. The UN Security Council has demanded their release, condemning the detentions in the strongest terms. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was outraged and called it a flagrant violation of Burkina Faso's constitution. Soldiers put a barricade around the presidential palace yesterday. Gunfire erupted several hours later as soldiers tried to disperse protesters outside the palace. It is not clear if there were any casualties. President Compaoré, who ruled Burkina Faso for 27 years, stepped down last October amid protests over his plan to amend the constitution so he could extend his stay in office. When the Presidential Guard seized power in Burkina Faso, it dissolved the transitional government just 3 weeks ahead of elections. From Abidjan, Emily Ayoub has more on the background of the coup with reporting from Ouagadougou by Zumana Wanogo.
Confusion reigns in Burkina's capital city, Ouagadougou. Soldiers from the Presidential Guard stormed the Ministerial Council Wednesday and took the country's president, vice president, and other ministers hostage before taking them away to their camp. As news spread, several hundreds of people gathered in the streets with the intention of freeing the prisoners. But soon, shots were fired to disperse the crowd. These protesters say it's not right. They are not allowed to shoot, he says. The protesters are not armed. He says everybody should be released. Early Thursday, a soldier, Colonel Mamadou Bamba, announced on state television that this is indeed a coup.
Le président de la transition est démis de ses fonctions. Le gouvernement de transition est dissous.
Bamba says the interim president is dismissed from his function. He says the transitional government and the National Transition Council are dissolved and that the consultation will take place to form a new government in charge of organizing inclusive elections. Burkina Faso was due to go to the poll for the first round of the presidential elections on October 11th. It has been a year since a popular uprising ousted former President Compaoré, who has tried to change the constitution to seek another term after 27 years in power. Earlier this year, transitional authorities enacted a new electoral code barring anyone who supported Compaoré's effort to change the constitution from running for office. The former ruling party condemned the measure, saying elections wouldn't be free and fair. The coup leaders pledged to organize inclusive elections in their statement Thursday. International Crisis Group analyst Cynthia Ohayon says the new electoral code upset the opposition. She says when one doesn't have the possibility to hope get back into power through the ballot, one is tempted to get it back through a different way. She says it's quite obvious that the former ruling party doesn't have the capacity to massively mobilize the population behind them, but it was also obvious that they had enough support within the army to raise the specter of a possible army intervention. On Monday, a government commission recommended disbanding the Presidential Guard, an elite military unit created by Campari and known by its acronym, the RSP. The fate of the 1,300-man unit has stirred tensions since Campari's overthrow. In February, civil society took the street to demand it be disbanded, accusing the unit of political assassination during Campari's rule. In July, the RSP called for the Prime Minister and former RSP second-in-command, Isaac Zida, to resign after he called for the unit to be disbanded. Ohayon says change is inevitable. She says the RSP doesn't have justification for its existence anymore, at least as a unit to protect the president. So changes have to happen, and the RSP knows that. She says that what is certain is that they will need an elected and legitimate authority to process these changes. Ohayon says the international community has a key role to play in resolving this crisis, as it can leverage the international aid that Burkina Faso depends on. Emilia Hop for VOA News in Abidjan.
The European Parliament has backed a plan to distribute some 120,000 migrants and refugees among European Union member countries. The plan is an effort to ease overcrowding in EU border nations that are the first stops for those seeking asylum. EU lawmakers voted to approve the measure today, 372 to 124, with 54 abstentions. The next move is for EU interior ministers to approve the plan. However, some Eastern European nations are against it. In related news, about 500 neo-Nazis demonstrated in Athens yesterday against the influx of migrants and refugees. They waved flags and shouted "Greece for Greeks and foreigners out." The leader of the Golden Dawn Party says Greece must stop hosting foreigners and send them home. One protester described the demonstrators as patriots. Most of those entering Greece are from Syria and are fleeing war. Also, Malta's Home Affairs Minister, Carmelo Abella, is calling on European countries to act responsibly to solve the crisis. He says countries should not take unilateral action. His comments came after Hungarian police fired tear gas and water cannons at migrants trying to climb the fence at the Serbian border. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon calls the tactics unacceptable, but Hungary's foreign minister has rejected criticism by Mr. Ban and others, calling their comments bizarre and shocking. Hungarian officials say the migrants were trying to push their way past the border fence and presented a danger to the country. After Hungary closed its border with Serbia this week, migrants began trying to enter Hungary through Croatia. Reports say Croatia will accept the migrants, but they must register with police. They will then be transported to the border with Hungary, which remains open for now. Croatia says some 5,600 migrants have entered the country since Hungary sealed its border with Serbia. Serbia's prime minister condemned what he said was Hungary's brutal treatment of the migrants. The world press has been saturated in recent weeks with images of refugees making the dangerous journey from Syria and parts of Africa to Europe, trying to find safety for themselves and their families. In this crisis, the suffering of children is most acute. To find out more about their plight, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Francine Wenuma of Save the Children. This week, she was on Serbia's border with Hungary, which has sealed its border with razor wire. She told Adam why her NGO is working to help refugees.
I think the first reason is because so many of these refugees are children. There are so many families who have fled Syria and who are still in the region as refugees and who have crossed into Greece and made this really arduous journey. And we're seeing children suffering who need very basic supplies. We see people who are carrying next to nothing because they can't carry things with them. They're going long distances and often on foot, carrying a few bags with them or having their children. You have people who are sleeping out in the open in parks. which is, of course, puts children at great danger and, you know, for exploitation and for other harm. And in some cases, they're in the hands of smugglers and of traffickers. You've heard of people being robbed and, you know, suffering from those people that they've paid money to along the way. But unfortunately, they have very few options. We see families with very, very young children and even the elderly and sometimes babies who are only a few months. They know that that is a very, very dangerous route. And those who choose to do it are choosing to take their family on that because of the violence that they are leaving behind. Put yourself in their shoes and you try to imagine if there's violence coming to where you live, to your homes, to the schools your children go to that have been actually attacked. What do you do and what are your choices?
It must be very difficult for you to see all this.
It is. There are so many children and so many needs that are currently not being met. You know, you see children who have been sleeping outside, you know, who just should not be in an environment where, you know, today, again, along the border, tear gas. Children are caught up in this situation, and it's not just the hardship that you see them experiencing here. We've had children in the region and in Syria tell us what they saw, and it's really heartbreaking to think of a three-year-old or a four-year-old or a five-year-old describing to us and making motions and gestures and saying, you know, there was a gun to their father's head. That's not something that a five-year-old should ever see. Children have told us that their schools were destroyed when they were in them, that they were attacked. And then they're out on the waves and they're out at sea. Often the crafts that they're on are not sturdy enough to make that journey. And unfortunately, we have seen people drown. We have seen children who have drowned. So that's one risk that's often very scary for them. Many had been in school before, and they're no longer in school. So they will still speak of the routine they had. They'll talk about missing their friend, you know, when they're in a neighboring country. You know, we try to provide spaces along the way where they can go and they can be safe.
Yeah, I mean, I think about how difficult it would be to feel like you're sort of protected by your parents and all of a sudden to realize that there are real dangers that your parents can't protect you from. In fact, your parents themselves are in danger.
That's correct. And I mean, I think that's the hard thing is it's a stress on both. It's a stress on the children and it's a constant stress on the parent. They can't stand to see their children subjected to violence. And so they do make that decision to leave. And I think that's what's often missed in the debate around this crisis. Every day that the EU is debating about this issue is a day that children are sleeping outside. Children need food. They need medical care because of what they're exposed to and that, you know, the risks for their health as well. It's hot. People are coming through hot climates and they need water during the day, but then they're also sleeping out in the open and they don't have adequate protection in the places where it's cold and sometimes rainy.
That was Francine Unema of the international NGO Save the Children on the Serbia-Hungary border. She was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Humanitarian groups say 240,000 people in Somaliland face severe food insecurity due to a prolonged drought. The Gou rains, which fall between April and June, were poor last year and again this year. Hassan Noor is country director of Somaliland and Somalia for Save the Children. From Nairobi, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the drought conditions in Somaliland.
At the moment, the situation in Somaliland is becoming worse because they have failed rains, and because of that, they have not been able to produce agriculture or they have not been able to feed the livestock well, and then there is significant shortage of water. This is an area which is quite remote in Somaliland, and therefore it remained undetected for quite a while, and therefore humanitarian assistance is needed. And these are the people who are towards the Djibouti border and the area which is between Djibouti border and the Red Sea. The coastal belt area, that is where the main problem is.
Now, I understand that a number of communities are taking, quote, desperate steps to deal with the situation. Can you explain what that means?
So the desperate steps are that they are selling their livestock. It is important to note that around 75% of the community here is agropastoralist, and they rely heavily on livestock for their livelihoods. Now the situation is such that to sustain their lives, they have to sell the livestock. Because there has been no rains, the condition of livestock and the health of livestock has really deteriorated, which is resulting in selling animals less than half the actual price. for future, they don't have any particular mean to cope with any shock. And the other thing that they're doing is they're migrating, so they will be leaving their homes and coming towards the towns or moving into the other side of the Ethiopian border to gain refugee status and get assistance from their agencies on that side.
Now, I understand that children have been particularly hard hit by the effects of the drought. Could you tell us about that?
When we did assessment, we realized that the average meal for children is one per day. And that is now resulting in an increasing level of malnutrition. I saw some of the very, very severe cases of acute malnutrition. I'm running nutrition programs for the last 10, 12 years, but I have never seen such cases of malnutrition. And that was alarming.
So what can be done?
The humanitarian community needs to step up. Donors need to put more money into the response. And then there needs to be a significantly scaled-up response, particularly in areas of water supply, wash, nutrition, and food. So these are three immediate things that need to be done for the population. And then in the longer run, there would need to be efforts taken to improve animal health and then provision of fodder or other livestock feed so that the animals are not dying.
Hassan Noor is country director of Somaliland and Somalia for Save the Children. From Nairobi, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Burkina Faso's military says it has seized power in the West African country and named a general to lead a new ruling authority. And the European Parliament has backed the plan to distribute some 120,000 migrants and refugees among European Union member countries. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. In Burundi, there's been months of street clashes and an exodus by the thousands. But today, buses are running and the police and military are patrolling the streets of the capital, Bujumbura. VOA's Edward Ruima talks to David Arnold about a relative calm after months of violence sparked by the July re-election of President Pierre Nkurunziza.
One thing that I would say that is different from the last 2 months when I was here is that the capital city of Burundi, which is Bujumbura, is more calmer and quiet these days compared to last time. We would hear lots of gunshots, but these days it's been almost 5 days here, and I only had a few gunshots only yesterday. So things seem to be calm, but one thing that is coming up these days is, though there hasn't been so much shooting, where every single day we hear reports of lifeless bodies being found in different suburbs of the capital, Bujumbura.
Is that typical of all neighborhoods in the capital city?
Security, I would say, is still tight in the neighborhoods which were strongholds of protests. Here I'm talking of neighborhoods like Zaga, Takura, Chibitoke, Ngagara. In these neighborhoods, there's still a lot of police presence. There's still a lot of military presence. And these are the same neighborhoods that I'm telling you about, that last night we had shootings going on in two of those neighborhoods. So besides those neighborhoods that were strongholds of protests and demonstrations, other neighborhoods seem to be okay and calm.
I understand you had an interview with the mayor yesterday. How did he describe Bujumbura now?
The mayor told me that things seem to be going on well, and said this is thanks to consultations he's been having with different local leaders and meeting those people that used to protest all the time. So he said overall security is improving. Right now they are looking at how they can restart all the activities in the city by engaging the youth, making sure that those the youth that are redundant are given to do, coming up with small cooperatives to help these youth, because most of the time these are the youth that are used by political actors here in the capital of Bujumbura. But all in all, he's optimistic that things may be heading to a better place. But again, when you speak to people around here in Bujumbura, people on the grassroots, people who are walking on the streets, they still say that they are not confident yet that that security that they would need here in Burundi. And there's also a slight mistrust that is going on between the police and the local population because the local population don't trust the police anymore. City services are going on, taxis, buses, moving people from within the city, even moving people from upcountry, they are going on. The banks are open until 5. When I was here 2 months ago, most of the banks used to close at 3 p.m. So I would say all the services are up and running right now.
I have heard reports that many of the opposition who were active in the past are out of the country now. Is there any effort to restart dialogue with the opposition?
Last night, the Speaker of the Parliament was heard on the national television saying that very soon they plan to restart the inter-Burundi dialogue. He didn't mention when that is going to happen exactly. But like you say, most of the opposition out of the country, most of them are either in Rwanda or other neighboring countries.
That's VOA's Edward Ruima talking to David Arnold about the relative quiet in Burundi's capital. Residents in northern Cameroon say suspected Boko Haram fighters have killed 8 people and kidnapped an unknown number of others for collaborating with Cameroon security forces in the nation's border village of Isahardi near a military base in Mora. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Pierre Robert, a resident of Isahardi village near a military base in Mora, said in a telephone interview that about 30 assailants stormed the village early Thursday and moved from door to door, reading the names of people from a list. He said when someone's name was read, he was accused of collaborating with Cameroonian soldiers and immediately killed or taken away. He says 3 women and 5 men were slaughtered and their houses were burned. He says Cameroon soldiers arrived 3 hours after the incident, saw the corpses and started investigations, but it is still early to say how many were kidnapped. Midiyawa Bakari, the governor of Far North Cameroon, confirmed the attack, saying a few houses were burned and the military is combing the hills on the border with Nigeria to track the assailants. Isahardi is some 10 kilometers from Mora, where there is a base of the Joint Task Force to fight the insurgents. More than 2,000 Cameroonian soldiers are at the base. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA. Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
When news is happening,
VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burkina Faso's military says it has seized power in the West African country and named a general to lead a new ruling authority. And the European Parliament has backed the plan to distribute some 120,000 migrants and refugees among European Union member countries. Coming up, music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment in South Sudan, economists say the signed peace deal provides a chance to revive the nation's economy. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
I understand you have some news for us on the All-Africa Games.
Lots of All-Africa Games news, Yehias. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's kick off with the All-Africa Games football tournaments being held in Congo, Brazzaville. Senegal will go against Burkina Faso in Friday's gold medal match in the men's tournament. How's it shaping up?
Well, Sonny, it's just as well I'm not a betting man, because right from the start of this tournament, I thought it was going to be a Congo-Brazzaville-Nigeria final. And when both sides got through to the semifinals, I was feeling pretty good with myself. But it just didn't work out that way. And as you said, it's Senegal up against Burkina Faso. Neither side has ever been to the final before. And both sides were very deserved winners. 3-1 victory margins for both the Senegalese and the Burkinabe, and fully deserved. There was no flukes or no luck about these performances. The Congo-Brazzaville-Senegal match, Senegal almost scored in the very first minute, but they did score a superb goal from Dieng after 16 minutes, an acrobatic overhead kick with his back to the goal. As good a goal, Sonny, as you're going to see in Africa all of this year. And then Ibrahim Keita, who's like a skyscraper. He wears the number 9. He's a striker for the Senegalese. Typical Senegalese footballer, very tall, very strongly built. And after 37 minutes, he raced into the penalty area, caught the Congolese defenders unawares, and he made it 2-0. And at that stage, it looked like it was going to be a massacre. Whatever Claude Leroy said at halftime to the Congolese, it certainly woke them up. They got much more possession and much more territory early in the second half, and they reduced the deficit after 55 minutes and set up a really entertaining second half. To and fro, chances at both ends. Congo looking for the equalizer, Senegal looking for the killer third goal. And it was the Senegalese who got that killer third goal, 8 minutes from the end, across Keita, a very powerful and well-directed header into the corner, 3-1 to Senegal. Could lightning strike twice when Burkina Faso met Nigeria later in the day? Yes, indeed it did. It was a very similar pattern. And once again, whereas Keita was the danger man for Senegal, it was Sidney Mohamed Silla, another player who really wasn't known before the All-Africa Games, who did a lot of the damage for the Burkinabe. He opened the scoring. Kabore made it 2-0 midway through the second half. And then Eto'o scored for Nigeria. It was pegged back to 2-1 now, and a chance for the Eagles to perhaps get a draw, force the game into extra time. But Burkina Faso were having none of that, and Silla struck again 11 minutes from the end for a deserved 3-1 victory. Now, the interesting thing is both Senegal and Burkina Faso only finished runners-up in their groups. In Group A, Nigeria emerged victorious with 4 points, Senegal at 2 from 2 draws, and Ghana, rather disappointing defending champions, they got only 1 point. In Group B, Congo finished with 6 points, Burkina Faso and Sudan 4 each, And here I've got a real moan, Sonny. They went for the drawing of lots, which I think is not the appropriate way to divide teams. And the problem was that both Burkina Faso and Sudan had identical records, same number of goals scored, same goal difference, same head-to-head record, and same number of points. So we had a drawing of lots. Burkina Faso won that. And then 24 hours later, they're in the final. So certainly luck on the side of Burkina Faso at the moment. If we then turn, Sonny, to the women, a similar situation, also a drawing of lots. And that meant that Ghana went through to the semifinals at the expense of South Africa. And Ghana made the most of their opportunity. They beat Ivory Coast by 1-0. And in the final, they will play Cameroon, who beat the once invincible Nigeria by 2-1. There was a time not that many years ago when it was Nigeria totally dominant in African women's football. And I think, Sonny, the fact that other countries are emerging, Cameroon, South Africa, Equatorial Guinea, Ghana, is healthy for the game. I don't think you want one team totally dominating the situation. So the finals again in the women, it's going to be Ghana against Cameroon. And in the men, surprisingly, but deservedly, it'll be Senegal against Burkina Faso.
David, Senegal will host the Africa Under 23 Cup of Nations tournament at the end of November. Is this good showing in Brazzaville perhaps an indicator that they're good bets for an Olympic qualifying berth next year?
Even before Brazzaville, in my mind, it's going to be Senegal, Egypt, and Nigeria who will qualify for the Olympics. Now, on that point, the draw has been made for the qualifying tournament in Senegal, which will start at the end of November and carry on till the middle of December. And in Group A, you've got Senegal, South Africa, Zambia, and Tunisia. And my gut feel here is Senegal are going to win this group, partly because of home advantage, partly because of the very difficult conditions. For example, the South Africans, it's going to be very hot in West Africa at that time of the year. So I see Senegal finishing on top. And then I think it's going to be a real battle, probably between Tunisia and South Africa for the second place in the semifinals. No disrespect to the Zambians, but they haven't been particularly impressive at under 23 level recently. That's a strong group, Sonny, but an even stronger one, in my opinion, is Group D, and that involves Egypt, who've got Karaba, a rising star in Africa. You've got Nigeria, who I feel, in a way, will almost benefit from their All-Africa Games experience because it will knock any overconfidence out of them, the fact that they didn't qualify for the final. And then you've got Mali, who tend to be quite combative in these competitions, and also Algeria. You rarely get a poor team from North Africa. I'm predicting Egypt and Nigeria, but I think, Sonny, things don't always work out the way David Legg predicts them. So, who knows?
David Legg get a prediction wrong? Never! And I'm sure our African football guru will have more predictions down the road, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. David Legg mentioned that superb and acrobatic goal by Senegal's Cheku Dieng at the All-Africa Games. Well, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Italian footballer Alessandro Florenzi, whose 55-meter wonder goal gave Roma a one-all draw with defending champion Barcelona in the UEFA Champions League. Florenzi launched his audacious lob from near the sideline in Rome, and then he watched it sail over Barcelona goalkeeper Andre Marc ter Stegen for
for a dramatic equalizer after Luis Suarez's opening goal. Florenzi described his goal as something to remember. For sure, Alessandro. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma joins us now for a look back at some of Wednesday's highlights at the All-Africa Games in Congo, Brazzaville.
Kenyan Alice Aprot clocked 31 minutes and 24.18 seconds to set a championship record in women's 10,000 meters on Wednesday. The previous mark stood at 31 minutes and 26.05 seconds by Ethiopian Mestawet Tufa in Algiers, Algeria in 2007. For the second day running, Nigerian women bagged three gold medals in athletics. Claire Uke, Chinazom Amadi, and Uhunoma Osazua triumphed in women's discus, long jump, and heptathlon, respectively. Meanwhile, Abdelmalek Lahlulu triumphed in men's 400-meter hurdles, and for the third time this year set an Algerian national record of 48.67 seconds. Egyptian Mustafa El Gamal clinched the gold medal in men's hammer throw. Algerian Hicham Khalid Cherabi triumphed in pole vault. Botswana's Nigel Amos was victorious in men's 800 meters, and Ivory Coast won the men's 4x100-meter relay. In basketball, Egypt pipped Nigeria 61-60 and Angola beat Mali 76-62 in men's semifinals on Wednesday. Mozambique outwitted Republic of Congo 79-68 in a classification tie. In women's classification matches, Mozambique dismissed Ivory Coast 90-56 as Cameroon outwitted Gabon 54-46. In handball, Nigeria edged Ivory Coast 25-20 in women's quarterfinals on Wednesday. Cameroon outplayed Burkina Faso 41-19. Senegal dismissed Republic of Congo 24-16, and Angola dismissed the Democratic Republic of Congo 29-22. In Olympic news, the cities of Budapest in Hungary, Hamburg in Germany, Los Angeles in the United States of America, the French capital Paris, and the Italian capital Rome are bidding to stage the 2024 Olympics. The International Olympic Committee, IOC President Thomas Bach, disclosed in Lausanne, Switzerland, the IOC will contribute $1.7 billion in cash and services to the organizing committee for those games. Finally, the International Olympic Committee has set up a $2 million fund for programs aimed at alleviating the growing global refugee crisis. The crisis is particularly acute in parts of Africa, Middle East, and Southern Europe. IOC President Thomas Bach says the Olympic movement seeks to play a part in bringing humanitarian help to refugees.
Thanks, Mark. That's Marco Uma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can tune in Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Send me a tweet or send me a message on Facebook. I appreciate the feedback. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, protest against the treatment of vendors in Zimbabwe. And next, in South Sudan, economists say the signed peace deal provides a chance to revive the nation's economy. But first, some music. Here is Manny Martin of Rwanda with Baba Nina. Thank you.
Mama, wajua nakupenda. Na mimi najua wanitakia mema. Sintosahau ulivyonihangaikia mama, pasipo msaada wa yeyote. Mama, ukihau kuna kule mateso tele, ili uninusuru na njaa, nikapata lishe, malezi na mavazi kwa jasho lako mama. Nilielimika, ulilinda na maradhi, ila sasa mama, wakati umewadia, swala moja nyeti nifahamishe mama, nifunulie siri na kusita, tafadhali nieleweshe mama. Baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Nikiwa nikichelema sikutilia maanani umuhimu wa kujua ukweli kama nikiulizwa baba. Mama, naomba nieleweshe, wala ni yule mwalimu aliyenifundisha shuleni. Baba ni nani mama? Baba ni nani? Ningemjua ningemwita mzazi akajibu mwanangu. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua.
Manny Martin, Afro Wanda with Baba Aninani. More than 600 members of the Zimbabwe Arise group recently protested the treatment of vendors by the government. Sithand Kilimalanga reports from Harare.
Here in Harare, the specific reason why we take it as the minister is that there is an issue to do with the first plastic dressing cup, where apparently the goods that are looted from the poor people are given to the poverty control campaigns. So what is the minister to answer is why, in fact, the looted things are taken to benefit the first lady and her campaign. They cannot loot from poor people who are trying to make ends meet for patronage reasons.
But the local authorities say they have made measures in place to reallocate vendors to designated vending sites. Do you think there are better alternatives?
We can't be patient when people are starving. These are people's lives that we're talking about. It's a matter of agency. They are allocating people in outskirts where there's no people who can buy it. These people are not saving so that they can just pass in the time and be able to own weather elements. They want to save so that they can make ends meet and feed their families and take their families to school. Like taking someone and putting them in the bush and say, who's going to go there? No one's going to go there. So it's a nine cycle. That's why we are saying it's not good enough. Go back to the drawing board, think afresh.
If you can briefly summarize for us some of your demands.
Firstly, we want the accountability of related things. Where are they taken to? That is in Harare. Particularly in Harare. In Harare also was an issue that is where the private company that collects fees from the vendors, and then the city council is collecting, so they double collection. And also we want the vending spaces to be where it's profitable for people. This is the only way that people can earn a living in Zimbabwe. It's not their fault that there was bad governance.
That was Sithan Kilamalanga reporting from Harare. In South Sudan, economists say the signed peace deal provides a chance to revive the nation's economy by reforming resources management and ending corruption. But the recent Juba event sponsored by the Ebony Center, experts seemed skeptical about whether the rival groups would be able to work together to accomplish anything in the transitional government of national unity. Philip Tonaleyu reports from Juba.
Leading economist Kenyi Spencer, who present a paper for the Ebony Center, says if the resource, economic and financial reforms are implemented, as spelled out in Chapter 4 of the peace deal, South Sudanese will attain something they have yearned for a very long time. Spencer says public finances, for example, have not been handled properly for years.
And this is where I think we have gone wrong, and this is where I think the guns are not silent in the bushes, because people's expectations have not been met according to what they were given as an expectation, that once peace comes, the peace dividend will be so great, especially for you who are in the oil-producing states. But that did not happen, and I think this is where we go wrong.
The agreement states that President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar must ensure transparency and accountability in order for South Sudan to achieve sustainable development. It also states that any leader found to have condoned or engaged in corrupt practices shall be barred from holding public office. Spencer says that apart from properly managing profits from the oil sector, managing the country's abundant natural resources is also very important. He says the Ministry of Petroleum, the Petroleum and Gas Commission, and the Nile Petroleum Limited should expand their horizons.
At the moment, we are using only 8% of the commercial value of our crude, and that is because we are selling the liquid part, and we think that that's the oil. Had we to go into looking into some of the small critical components of the crude, things like sulfur, things like the thallium, things like selenium, the chemicals that are within there, we would be having pharmaceutical industries all over the place. We would be vulcanizing rubber for making tires. We would maybe be assembling cars like Katrumi is doing, because they are pursuing the local material.
Spencer says the government and company executives should also refer the environmental damage caused by oil drilling activities. He says the transitional government must seek new ways of petroleum exploration, and local communities should be compensated when that exploration disrupts their livelihoods. Peter Biarajak, an economist with the International Growth Center, says the establishment of a national revenue authority within 6 months of the transitional period is a vital clue in the peace agreement. All revenues from oil and other sources must be deposited into a single treasury account according to the agreement. Biar says a lot of misery surrounds the issue of which account South Sudan revenue are kept in.
Because we have discovered time and again that policymakers will go and create their own account, and then sometimes you are confused about which account is the money being deposited.
Biar says another important component of the peace deal is following through on revenue sharing between the national government and local administrative units. That is supposed to be worked out during the first 2 months of the transitional period. Biar says those provisions are aimed at curbing corruption and speeding up service delivery to the people. Whether that actually happens, he says, is something altogether different.
So we are great at coming up with these great words, but IGA now has helped us. So these words are there, but they were not being implemented. So you have all these words, but what we observe, especially in the allocation of money, you see that there is pro-cyclicality of government spending. What I mean by this is expenditures are driven by revenues, not by planned excess.
Biar notes that between 2005 and 2011, oil prices were at a record high. At the same time, government spending surged. He says certain ministries spend hundreds of times more than the allocated amount. To make matters worse, the oil revenue stabilization account, which was set up to save excess money for future use, was instead deflated thanks to corrupt officials. James Alishigaren, an economist with the Ebony Center, says while the peace deal may be a bit too ambitious, there are provisions that can be acted upon immediately, like the one about requiring the government to support citizens financially with reconstruction funds.
So we are saying here, match the two such that you could now end up with a structure which is both doable and appealing, and that should be called a special reconstruction and development fund. This should be a fund where you fool all the resources from the government and from the donor into one basket.
The Kiir administration, the SPLM in opposition, former political detainees and other political parties will all take part in a 30-month transitional government of national unity. That government is to be formed by November. For BOA News, I am Philip Van Aleu in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 18 and 16 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Officials in the Central African Republic are working diligently to prepare for long-awaited national elections, despite some organizational challenges. Vote organizers face difficult circumstances as they seek to find solutions to address the country's vast interior and minimal infrastructure and bring the ballot to all eligible voters. Owing to these challenges, voter registration is behind schedule in some provinces, and officials continue to work to compile an accurate voter list. Further, before the elections can be held, the public also has to vote on a new constitution designed to form the base of the next government. The Transitional National Council finalized a draft of the constitution on August 30th, and the national referendum is scheduled for October 4th. Elections were originally due in February, but have already been postponed twice. The United Nations, which has a 12,000-strong peacekeeping mission in the country, and partner nations have warned that significant delays beyond the current elections calendar could worsen security. Nevertheless, as work to prepare for the vote continues, some progress has been made in laying the groundwork for credible elections that usher in a legitimately elected government. The CAR's Transitional Constitutional Court upheld a clause in the Transitional National Charter on August 28th, that bars current and former senior transitional government members from running when the vote is finally held. The United States commends the court for its decision, which upholds the rule of law and provides a clear signal to the people of the CAR that political authority in their country is bound by the tenets of the interim constitution, not arbitrary decisions. We call upon all members of the transitional government, past and future, to respect the court's ruling. The United States further commends the Constitutional Court for its strong rulings in January and July in favor of including refugees in the elections, an important decision that seeks to ensure that the elections are representative and that the CAR's future is inclusive of its entire population. We call upon the transitional government, including those in charge of elections preparations, to reinforce the spirit of the decision by redoubling efforts to organize and expand elections preparations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk. What is blind date? Does it lead to an everlasting relationship? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing blind dates. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.